Welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Today I talked to Paul Smith, a Métis writer and activist right here in Guelph. You may remember Paul from episode number 40 of the Politicast, or from his numerous appearances on the old Beyond the Ballot Box show. But as we look ahead to the 2019 federal election, Indigenous issues should be top of mind. Has the Trudeau government done the job in terms of improving life for Canada's Indigenous people as promised in the 2015 campaign? The results have been mixed, to say the least, but what happened to that spirit of hope and change? Catching up on Indigenous issues is the topic of this edition of the Guelph Politicast. Let's scan through the news from the last couple of months. How is life faring for our Indigenous friends in this modern Canada? From CTV on December 19, Manitoba Premier says he will enforce fee on Indigenous cannabis retailers. From the Globe and Mail on December 14, Commissioners of Inquiry find over 100 systematic causes for violence against Indigenous women. From Global News on December 14, Ford government cuts funding to Ontario Arts Council impacting Indigenous Cultural Fund. From CBC Radio's The Current on November 13, Indigenous women kept from seeing their newborn babies until agreeing to sterilization, says lawyer. So the news isn't that great. Indigenous communities all across this country still face enormous systemic issues, not to mention a few new ones for good measure, like those cuts to education and support for Indigenous culture that just happened here in Ontario this year. Perhaps it was naive to think that hundreds of years of neglect would be resolved in just 4 short years, but can we at least say that there's been some progress? That's why I wanted to have Paul Smith back on the podcast. Paul is a freelance writer whose works have appeared in local papers and websites like StrikeGoods.com, and he also once served as counselor on the Grand River Métis Council. Back in June 2016, Paul was still optimistic about the promise of the then-new Liberal government. As it turns out, Paul is still optimistic about how things are changing for Indigenous people, even in the midst of recognizing all those complex challenges that are still being faced by Canada's First Nations population. So on this edition of the Guelph Politicast, Paul Smith and I discussed where Indigenous people stand at the end of 2018. We talk about how he's feeling about the Trudeau Liberals now after nearly 4 years, whether awareness counts as victory when it comes to Indigenous affairs, and what Indigenous victories and struggles around North and South America mean for Canada's First Nations people. We also talk about the ongoing issues Indigenous communities are facing, Paul's thoughts on the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, and the surprising answer as to what the Conservatives' stand on Indigenous issues should be during the campaign to come. Again, there are no easy answers, but it's important to have the conversations and to keep having the conversations, and I think this one is a good one. So I caught up with Paul Smith in studio a few weeks before the holiday break. Paul Smith, thanks for joining me today.
You bet. Tanshi, Ani Buju.
I appreciate that. Given the spirit of the conversation here today.
Exactly, yeah. And in fact, we could even do a little territorial acknowledgement.
By all means.
We're on the, we're on the land of the treaty lands of the Mississauga of the New Credit. And it's particularly relevant because the anniversary, I think it's the 223rd anniversary of the signing of the treaty that includes the lands of Guelph with the Mississauga. 1792.
On this day?
No, in early December. I think it's the 8th or 11th or something.
All right. Yeah. Okay, well, good timing then. Unplanned, but good timing. I won't pretend to be an expert on the affairs of Indigenous history or the history of Indigenous affairs. The reason I wanted to get you back in the podcast is because, you know, I was thinking about, we're coming up on a federal election and Indigenous issues are going to hopefully be front of mind. But we talked a little bit after the last federal election, and you were very hopeful. I remember you being very hopeful about the direction that the new government was going and hopefully where it was leading. And it's been over 2 years since. So I'm wondering where you are now on in terms of hopefulness, in terms of where you think the government is on indigenous relations.
Yeah, well, things have changed a lot in 2 years, and I think opinions have changed a lot too. But I think it's and I always like to remind people, like, there's a million plus indigenous, you know, First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people in Canada, so
right.
There's a lot of opinions,
right,
about Trudeau, about, you know, Doug Ford or whoever. There's a lot of opinions, so it's right. Diverse, and I like to reflect that because it's there are different opinions, right? But I mean, I guess I would say that you know, I think the first thing I think is probably worth talking about is the change in the discourse generally, public discourse, and I think that's really shifted dramatically in terms of 2 years ago and you know, 5 years ago. Now we're talking about things that we would never really talked about in terms of First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people.
Right.
And I don't think that's all politics. I think that's partly, you know, what's happening in society. And generally speaking, civil society has morphed, and they've accepted that, you know, this is the issue, one of the issues of our day. Mm-hmm. This is the issue we're collectively working on together and working through it. And partly it's the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and partly it's, I mean, right after that for a few years and continues, more reports came out kind of reinforcing the issues, you know, the social and prosperity, lack of prosperity issues and health issues for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people over and over again. So I think it kind of hammered people. The 2015 with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was one thing, but then it kept being emphasized over and over again. People kind of like, there's a greater acceptance now across the board. And I think there's lots of activities that are going on that are kind of building on that. So I think the explosion in the arts in Indigenous writing and music and film, you know, you would never get the sales of books like, you know, Birdie and all of Richard Wagamese's books and The Break and authors like that would never have been on the scene like they are now. They're bestsellers, right? Mm-hmm. You wouldn't, like, there are no Indigenous bestsellers before, really, previous to the current era. There are some, but they're pretty modest, right?
Right,
and now we're having Indigenous books on Canada Reads and all kinds of things like this. So there's a real change and that, I think, that area particularly is leading the charge. I mean, the media is doing a reasonable job, I guess. You know, CBC has unreserved program, and they have the reclaimed program now. And Tanya Talaga was just on the ideas. She did the Massey lectures this year, so that's
right.
A real. You would never, a decade ago, you would never have had that probably. So I think the whole public discourse has changed. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily evolved such that it's a very informed, but I think it's sort of. I like to say that, you know, Truth and Reconciliation, but there's before that, there's the ignorance phase. And we're not really out of the ignorance phase. We've got a fair amount of truth in the last few years, but there's still a lot of ignorance. And we're kind of, but I guess a lot of Indigenous people review reconciliation as, I'd say a bunch of, there's a big sector of the population see it as a joke.
Right.
And others are still more hopeful we're on the path, but it's going to be a long path. But a lot of people are, you know, maybe resentful or of the lack of movement.
Right.
And that kind of ties to the political scene, I think. And so people would, and again, there's different perspectives. So the federal Liberals have moved in a bunch of areas. But, you know, this is a big agenda, so it's hard to make progress. So, you know, he's got Jane Philpott working on the services side. He split the department into two pieces, and Jane Philpott, who is kind of a doer, but she's pretty successful, competent minister, and she's working on getting those water systems up to scratch. She's working on, you know, trying to eliminate tuberculosis from the north, and she's got a whole bunch of things she's working on. And she's got, you know, Carolyn Bennett continuing on the work. But he's also ticked a lot of people off, right?
Right.
So, you know, the pipelines, for those, and there's lots of First Nations and others that are opposed to the pipelines, so that's, but not everyone's opposed to the pipelines. So,
right.
You know, like the Métis Nation of Alberta voted in support of the Trans Mountain Pipeline. So, but there's lots of people who are. So that's ticked a lot of people off. And then there's, right now, there's this, they've got this Indigenous rights framework that they started pushing a couple of years ago that they wanted to, I think it was after a number of court decisions, they decided, well, we need to kind of make sense of this, and so our legislation isn't totally offside. So it seemed like maybe a good idea, but now they've got really got people, the Assembly First Nations, and lots of, there's sort of a movement against it, and a lot of, there's a fair amount of conspiracy theory that
right.
this is, he's trying to do what his dad tried to do, because his dad tried to erase, you know, the Indian Act and Indians essentially from the landscape in 1969, right? So so there's a lot of weird thinking going on about it. But at any rate, he's ticked a lot of people off with that. So,
right. The thing I find interesting, and the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls inquiry sort of falls into that, is that there's an element to what the federal government's been doing that seems well-intentioned, but either because they want to be seen doing it, they want to get it done, they want to get it done fast because, you know, we're talking about hundreds of years of inaction, basically. But, you know, they can't help themselves. It's a bureaucracy. Bureaucracy sometimes steps on its own feet in spite of itself. And you know, the missing and murdered Indigenous women inquiry is a big piece of that. It's probably the most high profile piece of that. And anytime we kind of hear something about it, it's usually about some person departing. It's about it, this being over budget. They need more time. The federal government doesn't want to give them more time. It just seems like, from my point of view, as someone who wants to be a good ally to Indigenous people, white people still screw it up. Right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, there's a certain amount of journalistic... Journalism is not perfect, like any human endeavor, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the coverage tends to focus, for whatever reason, it tends to focus on the negative around the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls inquiry. And for good reason. There's been lots of personnel problems, you know, people leaving and commissioner leaving and various staff leaving. And there seems to be a history of that over the length of it. But having said that, I mean, the same thing happened to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in its early years. It got more stable after a couple of years, but it had big troubles in the beginning too. So, but I mean, I guess it, you know, it's, and I think people who, from what I read, people who have gone to the events that they've had for the families have found them helpful and useful, and they've been able to speak, and they've had a sort of a healing quality to them that has been good for them. So, I mean, I guess the proof of the pudding is always in the eating, so we'll have to see what the final report is. Their interim report was, you know, had some stuff in it. But I think they were really trying to get that extension, which in my mind, I think they should have given them an extension. It was kind of goofy just to try to cut it off before the election. In my mind, from the very beginning, it should have been longer to start with. So it seemed like a odd thing to not give them an extension. I mean, maybe there's sort of inside stories. I don't know. But it seemed like a bad idea not to give them the extension, because you got it going, may as well get the most out of it.
Right. It seems like the politics angle of it. We have to be finished this by the time we're running for re-election so that we can say we can finish it. We finished it.
Yeah, maybe that's the logic. I don't know. Yeah. And if it is, that's unfortunate. Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to jump back for a second, because you were talking about a lot of the cultural stuff that's come out of this. And I, of course, that's positive, but I feel like that's the easy stuff in reconciliation, is, you know, making room for Indigenous people. And I'm wondering how you're feeling about, like, you talked about, you know, water issues on reservations. I mean, that's, I think, the biggest, one of the biggest pieces of all this is just the basics, though, you know, making sure you have access to clean water. And
yeah,
it just seems like we can't do anything about that. Again, it seems like we white people can't help but screwing things up in that regard. And that's, you know, that's the basic stuff. I just feel like, yeah, having more indigenous books out there and giving indigenous authors that support, that's easy.
Yeah. Well, this is a long-term thing. So right. The easy stuff will obviously be the early successes. And I guess, you know, I mean, on one hand, I probably would give the government some credit on removing a bunch of those boil water advisory and getting some water systems. You know, that's a big job too, right? It's a lot of money, a lot of training, a lot of infrastructure in remote places. So, I mean, I think they're making progress on that. I wouldn't give them, you know, a blank check on that. I think more significantly, I guess there's a couple of big crises that are worse now than they were 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like the child welfare piece, the number of kids in care is like, I think it's like, what is it, 52% of the kids in some kind of care, child care, right. Or not child care, but
foster care,
yeah. and group homes and so on is 52%, but in that age group, Indigenous children make up 7.5%. So, and it's really out of control. And people are calling it the millennial scoop. They're talking about this is like the 60s scoop, but
right.
It's worse,
right?
Because there's more kids in Indigenous kids in care now than there were in residential schools at the height of the population of the schools, and this leads to huge. I mean, this just snowballs into problems as their life goes on, right?
Right.
If you're taken away from your family and put into foster care, you know, it leads to crime, leads to drug problems, leads to, you know,
emotional
trauma,
problems,
all
psychological
kinds of
problems,
things.
Yeah.
And even the feds recognize it. So Jane Philpott recognized it. She called it a humanitarian crisis, right? And it's worse. Those numbers are worse if you look at Saskatchewan and Manitoba. So it is a crisis there's a cultural disconnect in the sense of, social workers, and social workers are mandated to do things. They're mandated to take kids out of their homes if they meet certain criteria. So it's almost they're damned if they do and damned if they don't.
Right.
So there's a legal problem, there's a social problem, there's a cultural problem, there's a disconnect between, you know, why put them into foster care when you could give them, give the kids to their grandparents, for example,
right.
Or to their aunts or uncles that are nearby on the reserve or in the community or whatever. So that, to me, is like a huge piece. And then I guess the other one, which is, in a sense, directly related, is the incarceration rate. So it's like, I think it's like 27% of the population is First Nations, Métis, or Inuit. And there's 4% in the full population of Canada. So,
right.
and the 27% is probably lowballed.
Right.
So it's probably higher because some people don't even won't identify when they go in.
Right.
So again, and this has gone up in the last few years, whereas the incarceration rate for everyone else has gone down.
Right.
So it's getting worse, and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court said, you know, this is completely unacceptable. And then that is a function. I mean, the increase is probably the increase right now is probably a function of Stephen Harper and his minimum sentence rules for so many things.
Right,
you get incarcerated regardless, right? But then you have the systemic justice system problems, you know, like people talk a lot about Colton Bushy and Tina Fontaine's as the verdicts in those cases as being examples.
Right.
But, you know, you can scratch, there's lots and lots of that going on as well, the jury system and so on.
Right.
So I think between, you know, the child welfare state of that and incarceration rate, essentially you're creating tomorrow's problems by doing that. So by taking all those kids into foster care and incarcerating people who really probably should be handled otherwise, you're creating tomorrow's problems. So you're perpetuating the problems we already have, and they're not getting any better. It's not getting better. And the suicide rates are associated with particularly the foster care situation and social conditions in remote communities. And I mean, that's, for example, one of the big issues for the Inuit. Like, they have an even higher suicide rate in Nunavut and Nunavik and the northern parts of NWT and so on. So, you know, those are big problems. So obviously, as you say, you know, the easy stuff will be a win, but these are harder problems to fix that take a generation, but doesn't seem to be going in the right direction in those cases.
It's weird then that there's this disconnect that we have more awareness. I mean, over 100 people came out in Guelph for that demonstration of solidarity with Colton Bushy's family. That you know, you were able to drag over 100 people out in Guelph on a cold Saturday. Not all of them were Indigenous, and many of them were you know, settler. That we have this incredible, almost hyperactive awareness now of the problems Indigenous people face. But as you said, in some ways it's getting worse. I think maybe in the most important ways it's getting worse in terms of how our Indigenous people live. And I think that's tough to wrap your head around, how we can be more aware, but the problem isn't. Our awareness and action to solve a problem don't seem tied together.
Yeah, but I would say, you know, these problems we're talking about, I mean, again, with a million plus Indigenous people, you know, there is a middle class, First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people, and you know, once you get out of the, you know, there's a thriving middle class and lots of, you know, like Guelph hired 6 new academics, and so there's an intelligentsia, if you like, and as well. So there's a so there's a disparity between the people who are really suffering from the various traumas and people who are able to escape that, or maybe never part of it too. You know, because not every place is the same; they're all different. So, and there's a lot of urban Aboriginal people too. So people are growing up, you know, in cities and as well. So it's complicated, but I guess that's the other thing about, you know, some of this stuff is that, like the incarceration stuff and the, drugs and foster care pieces, that law and order is an issue for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people too, because law enforcement and the rule of law is not what it should be in remote communities on reserves and in remote communities. So there's an underfunding of First Nations police, for example, and the governance, you know, they go from contract to contract. They're often kind of left hanging, not knowing whether they're getting the same amount of money. So that it doesn't attract the kind of stable career-minded people that they might, and that, again, something that's been moved on, and that's kind of a low-profile issue, but it makes a big, you know, if you live in an unsafe community where there's lots of gangs and drugs and people are taking over your community and have positions of power that they shouldn't, and there's no law enforcement, well, you know, that just creates all kinds of other social problems too, right? So, you know.
But yet, again, it comes down to, you think that would be sort of an easy place for the government to intervene. I mean, who protests more money for police? Well, some people do, but it generally is seen as sort of a winning issue, no matter what your political party is to support law enforcement.
And there is progress on that. Like, I know the Anishinaabe Aski Nation has got a good new agreement with, I think it was the feds, and maybe it's both of them. So they've got some long-term stable funding, and they got a pretty good police force, and so there is progress on that too. So it is something that's being addressed. There's a lot of these things that are kind of below the radar that don't get press coverage, right? Because they're not. There's so many aspects to it that you know,
it's a press release.
The media has a, you know, is subject to the shiny baubles too, right? You know,
was that a shiny bauble? I want to consider this question and maybe you have an opinion, is awareness a victory? Because a lot of these issues were under the surface for so long. They didn't make the nightly news. It was, you know, unless you lived in somewhere near where there was a big First Nations population, you know, maybe in the rural prairies and, mm-hmm. and northern Ontario. But the fact that, you know, we're sitting here in Guelph in an urban community and we're talking about this, is that a victory?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you're right. That is a victory because you're right. Some of this coverage would never make the mainstream media. And you know, 5 years ago, if you watched APTN mm-hmm. and you watched the mainstream media, you would see things that you on APTN that you would never that were big news on APTN mm-hmm. that you'd never hear about on in the mainstream media. I mean, it's still the case to some degree,
mm-hmm.
But it's less stark now, and you do get and like the CBC has, you know, got lots of Indigenous reporters now, mm-hmm. and they're on shows, and you know, they're kind of interpreting it, and they add their own perspective for it, and so I do think the awareness is important, and as you say, you hear about things that happen where you might not have heard about them, whether it's suicides or good news too. So it's good news, bad news. So, yeah.
It was kind of a big deal a couple of weeks ago when you had Shanice Davids and Deb Haaland in the United States becoming the first Indigenous mm-hmm. congresswomen. Conversely, there's, you know, what's his name? Jair Bolsonaro. In Brazil, right. Basically saying that nowhere in the Amazon will be spared from development. In terms of the bigger picture, in terms of Indigenous communities in North America, do the victories there for representation have an effect here, you know, or even issues in these other places, do they have an effect back here in Canada, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's all connected, certainly, and you know, and there's certainly lots of back and forth between the two portions of Turtle Island here, but I do think lots of Native Americans are looking north to Canada for some inspiration too, because of things that are happening here, like the missing, murdered Indigenous women and girls. Commission, for example, the same situation exists in the United States.
Yeah.
So they're Native American women have all the same problems and that women, Indigenous women in Canada do, but it hasn't had the spotlight. Partly because, you know, they're a smaller proportion. It's about 1% of the population there. In Canada, it's like 4%, so it's that's partly part of it, but it's also the sort of invisibility. That's what I know a number of them are talking about during the election, that Native American vote was invisible, although it's interesting that they attempt to suppress the vote, or I guess it was successful really in North Dakota,
right
drew more attention to it and made, you know, the Native American vote more visible in the sense of, you know, had they not tried to suppress it so baldly.
Right.
to get rid of the Democrat successfully, I might add.
Yeah.
And the irony of requiring a residency, proof of residency for Native Americans was kind of pretty rich.
Wasn't lost on the people in North Dakota, yeah.
So, yeah. And I do think there's lots of people are kind of interconnected and they see the parallels between, and with Australia as well, and, you know, and the Inuit see, you know, talk to people in Greenland and Alaska as well. Mm. So there's lots of connections across the more, in a sense, more natural boundaries.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It just, I do feel, you know, when you talk about people like Shanice Davids and Deb Haaland, in 2018 in the United States, for them to be the first Indigenous women to be called congresswoman is flabbergasting. But I think that's there's something valuable to that in terms of just reminding us of how far behind the eight ball we are in terms of like true equality with the people who are descended from the original inhabitants here. that, you know, in 2018, we're still trying to make a place at the table for Indigenous people.
Yep. It's, yep. Yeah, and it's, I mean, it, and it is, there is a, it's colonization, right? Really, right. Is the, it's the big theme here, right? So it's a European colonization, and you can talk about Russian colonization of Siberia too. Mm. So you know, Siberia was never Russian before, you know, the Tsars took their troops out there.
Right.
So that's, and China is an imperialist colonizing force as well. So,
right.
But, you know, Australia's still going through lots and lots and lots of work they need to do on Indigenous people there too, and the, and they change governments every 6 months whether they need to or not. So
right.
It's hard to get a focus there sometimes. Right. But I think there's also lots of other progress that's been happening that's, again, a bit below the, like, I think there's been a change in how land claims have been approached, for example. And so there's a very recent settlement with the Williams Treaty First Nation. So the Williams Treaty covers areas sort of from like Cobourg on Lake Ontario up to Georgian Bay and kind of Algonquin Park.
Just a little area.
Just a little area. But it was a very late treaty signed well in the 20s. And it was after most of all the other treaties, and there were other treaties that kind of predated it. And it was a bit of a real anomaly, and they were essentially asked to give up way more than any other treaty before that. And they gave the courts ruled that they gave up their hunting and fishing rights. In fact,
right,
which was kind of a shocker,
kind of hard to believe. Too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what happened was the court ruling was way back in the 90s, and then Mike Harris took away some sort of transitional hunting and fishing arrangements they'd had with the NDP. So they took it to court. But instead of, you know, the Federal Department of Indian Affairs, it was at the time,
mm-hmm.
They were going to litigate it, but now in this new atmosphere of reconciliation, they actually negotiate it rather than take it to the Supreme Court. So there's a big settlement. There's a $1.1 billion settlement like a week and a half ago.
Mm.
And then each of the reserves get to add 11,000 acres to their land base as well. So this is huge, and they had a big celebration up at Rama for it. Doug Ford's minister, Greg Rickford, was there,
okay,
as well as the federal minister. So it was a big celebration for both Ontario. And so even the Conservatives have moved along from, you know, the kind of get the Indians out of the Ipperwash Park phase that they went through in the 90s. Even they've moved on to a more enlightened viewpoint, or it seems anyway. It's early days in the Ford regime, but it seems like, you know, there's a different... They've moved on as well. They're more, they understand the issues. And so that's kind of a huge, that was a big one, right? And right. The Lubicon Lake settlement out in Alberta again. So that's like, I remember that when I was almost a teenager, that was a big issue and that's settled as well. So I think it's affecting all kinds of relationships on many levels. And hopefully we'll see more of that in coming years, that kind of thing. Mm. So,
so where does this go from here? I think going back to where we started with, you know, where we were a couple of years ago, and we had the last election, as you pointed out, sort of was on the heels of Truth and Reconciliation Commission report, and very famously, there were elements of the government then who didn't seem particularly fazed by what was delivered. But, you know, this year, or this coming election, I should say, we're going to be following up on a lot of that. And I'm wondering, I guess, will those issues still be front of mind like they were in 2015? Or is it going to take maybe some lobbying to make sure that all the political parties, frankly, don't forget Indigenous matters in their platforms?
Yeah, well, that was one of the pieces of the campaign in 2015 that probably people weren't aware of, but there was some very strategic lobbying by Indigenous organizations. The Assembly of First Nations was very strategic. They produced a document called Closing the Gap, which kind of borrowed some concepts from Australia that I could see, because that was a big, that was sort of a theme that Australians used a lot, closing the gap. So it's a prosperity gap, the health gap, the education gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous, or in their case, First Nations. And so they lobbied on it, had a very specific agenda they were pushing, and the Liberals accepted pretty much all of that. And the Liberals got very specific in their mandates for, they had a mandate for that they put out during the election for First Nations. They put out one for Métis. They put out one for Inuit. So they had very specific commitments.
Right.
So it was remarkable the level to which, I mean, the Liberals are known for being policy wonks and like drilling down to the minutia, but they went a bit crazy, because they had that gigantic agenda, and that's how they got there. But I think it was pretty thoughtful the way they did it, and so you have to hand that to them that they didn't kind of go for the hot button, kind of, you know, a barbaric cultural practices kind of issue.
Yeah.
So, but I guess, you know, I mean, I'm always afraid that, to me, that's one of the dangers of the current environment related to thinking about First Nations, Métis, and Inuit issues, is that it becomes a captive of the left.
Right.
And I think that would be a really bad thing.
Right.
If because there is a diversity of opinion, again, within that million-plus population. And lots of conservatives and, you know, liberals and NDPers amongst that million plus. I mean, it may be a little more skewed. I think the polls are showing a little more skewed to the left. But, you know, there are lots of
difference.
Even in the MPs and MPPs, you see. So there are lots of conservatives that are First Nations, Métis, or Inuit. And so I think I would really hope that this becomes a non-partisan issue, the spectrum from one end to the other can see their own, maybe take a kind of different approach. You know, the right wing could be hopefully not like Tom Flanagan, but you know, sort of more entrepreneurial approach to it or whatever it might be, so that you could have a kind of an indigenous agenda that goes across the political spectrum, doesn't become a captive of the left or the center left or whatever it is. Because I think, you know, that there might be a tendency for that to happen, given what the Liberals campaigned on so heavily on that, and they'll probably try to commandeer that agenda themselves. So I hope that the Conservatives, you know, make a pitch. I mean, I guess that, you know, so good interesting example of that is Greg Rickford, so the provincial Indigenous Affairs Minister, also mines and so on, but he's from Kenora. Right. So he has a lot of First Nations and Métis voters.
Right.
And he apparently has worked on some of the remote First Nations up there too. So he understands his constituency.
Right.
And so he knows that he needs those folks to win too. So it's kind of, that's an interesting example of the need for a conservative to appeal to Indigenous voters.
Right. It should be a large piece of Indigenous matters is preserving a culture and preserving the language, preserving the history, making people aware of the history. And just hearing you talk right now, it makes you think, you know, that's sort of right up the conservative alley, because a lot of conservative value is about tradition. It's about preservation of things. The two should be able to tie together. That, you know, we want to help Indigenous people preserve their culture and reserve their culture. It shouldn't be political. And
no, that's right. Yeah. And the sort of the self-sufficiency is a big thing in many Indigenous cultures. And,
yeah.
And like the Métis were the sort of entrepreneurs of the fur trade. So
yeah.
So often kind of oriented. So there's a Métis minister in the Palliser government in Manitoba too. So so they're just an example of that kind of spread across the spectrum.
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Yeah.
Weird we should end this on a conservative message, but I mean, that's where these things go sometimes. But Paul Smith, I thank you for your insights today. McGwich, did I say that right?
Yeah, McGwich, merci.
Okay. I'll just simply end with saying thank you.
Thanks a lot, Adam. Appreciate it.
And once again, that was Paul Smith. Looking ahead to 2019, we'll see if Indigenous issues play a substantive role in the coming election as they did in that previous one, and I guess we'll stay tuned for that. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes, and while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can go to Guelph Politico on Facebook at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.